Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson. And today on the program, Deborah Colleen is here to talk about her new fantasy young adult novel, A Prince in Need. Deborah spent 15 years working as a pharmacist, so she never really found it the right fit. Having reached her limit with managed care, she transitioned careers into clinical research and writing novels. After receiving the requisite rejections from a number of agents and publishers, Deborah opted to self-publish her first two young adult fantasy novels. The first was An Unlikely Duke in 2005, and its sequel, A Prince in Need, in 2006. Duke recently won first place for young adult fiction in the Reader Views Literary Awards. And in 2006, Duke was picked up by Helm Publishing and was released at the end of April 2007. And Prince was also just released again in June of 2008. And the series will run for a total of 5 novels. Deborah resides in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where she shares a home with her sister and 5 very exceptional cats, Mandy, Scott, Finn, Isis, and Osiris. More information can be found about Deborah and her books through her website, www.meridia.net. And so I'm just so very happy to have Deborah on the phone today. Thanks for joining us today, Deborah.
Thank you, Juanita. I am thrilled to be here.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations, I have to say. You must be so excited to see A Prince in Need on shelves.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. How are you enjoying your new career writing novels? I'm assuming that this is really more along the lines of following your passion than your previous career.
Yes, in fact, I 10 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago, I didn't see myself writing fiction at all, but now it's just become so much a part of me, and I enjoy it just so much.
So were you writing as a child? Like, how did you get into this career?
I really kind of stumbled into it. I had written, you know, the requisite essays and the occasional short story for classes throughout my schooling, but I didn't intend to, you know, write long-term or anything of that nature. And then about 10 or 12 years ago, I had an idea for a story, and I didn't actually sit down to do anything more with that idea until about 8 years ago, and An Unlikely Duke was the result of that.
So did you must have had an original interest in the fantasy genre, is that correct?
Yes, I read a lot of fantasy when I was growing up through junior high school, college, and then I moved away from it for a while and kind of looped around back to it.
Mm-hmm. Then it's probably a pretty obvious transition for your first novel, if that was your original, you know, what inspired you as a young girl reading.
Yeah, I read a lot of fairy tales as a child, and that immediately segued into fantasy. I had read Tolkien, of course, Lloyd Alexander. One of my favorite books, and I still have a copy, my fourth grade teacher gave me The Phantom Tollbooth, and I still keep a copy of that on the shelf.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
So what is it that you think is, with this young adult fantasy novel that really, I mean, appeals to all ages and really can be extremely timeless?
Well, I think a lot of us, and kids especially, they haven't lost their sense of wonder and that innate belief in magic and miracles, and I think just they enjoy reading stories that deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, A Prince in Need is the second in the series of 5 called The Meridian Cycle. So tell us about your series, The Meridian Cycle.
Well, the cycle starts out with a couple of characters from actually our modern world, and in an effort to prevent the death of a ranking nobleman in an alternate universe, they travel to this other universe where magic happens to work, and the church is in the very controlling mode of the magic in this world, And, of course, the nobleman's death occurs anyway, hence this keeps the plot moving, of course. But these two characters choose to stay in this world, and I won't go into too many details for anybody who hasn't read An Unlikely Duke. But A Prince in Need picks up a few months later with the death of the King of Meridia.
Okay. So from what I understand, all of the books in this series will be able to stand on their own. Like, they are sequels, but you don't have to read book one, book two, like in consecutive order.
Correct. With An Unlikely Duke, the main story there was the death of this Duke, Christian Lattimore, and the search for his killer, and that whole storyline is resolved. There are a couple of other things occurring in the background that aren't resolved, which then lead into the plot of A Prince in Need. And my goal is that each of these stories can stand alone, even though the characters are all going through, you know, numerous changes, and ultimately a lot of things get resolved by the time the end of the fifth book.
Okay, so where exactly is Meridia? And tell us about this place.
Well, Meridia is somewhat similar to our European Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages. And again, with the big difference that this magical system works a lot more dramatically than what we see as magic in our world today or even throughout the years. And I had read a number of fantasy series back in the day where church and magic are always opposed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always a battle between the two. And I said, well, what if the church, instead of butting heads with magic, so to speak, actually embraced it, encompassed it, and is now controlling it? Because I saw some, you know, political potentials here.
Yeah.
I love that whole historical period and a lot of the political things that were occurring.
Very wrapped up in the church.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, what if I have this magical system, hand in glove with the church? You know, how is that going to drive some of the stories as well? And that was kind of my jumping off point.
Interesting. So tell us about Chris and Elijah. They're the two main characters of your first book, and they're still the main characters in your second?
Well, I have an ensemble cast.
Okay.
And Chris and Elijah are certainly two important characters. And one of the things that a lot of writing people will tell aspiring writers is to write what you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for a fantasy writer, that only works up to a point.
Yeah, right. True.
And so one of the things that I know about, having come through the healthcare system, is healthcare. I don't propose to be a medical expert by any imagination, but Chris and Elijah are both physicians, they're medical residents. So I've got that piece of background that I can talk credibly as far as that aspect of both of their characters. And, you know, they decide, they both have different issues with what they see as their residencies are coming to an end. What are they going to be doing, you know, as physicians?
Mm-hmm.
And Chris especially has some frustrations, and I'll be completely honest, a lot of those frustrations I share. And so he's kind of like, well, what am I going to do? My residency is coming to an end. I really don't want to work for some big managed care corporation. I really want to, you know, treat people. I want to help people.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I went into medicine to begin with. And so he gets this odd opportunity. An Unlikely Duke actually starts with a job interview. He's actually interviewing for a position he knows nothing about, and the man who's interviewing him is actually a bishop from this other world. He's a highly trained magician.
Oh.
And yes, he's gotten word of a conspiracy against the life of this Duke, and when he asks for guidance on how to solve this problem, you know, he's combining prayer and ritual, and a window opens in front of him. Well, this bishop, Edward, he doesn't think twice. He just steps through the window, and never mind the consequences. He ends up in modern-day Boston, and he's like, okay, now what do I do? He decides to start interviewing people to see if he can find somebody who can help him with his problem. And Chris comes to the interview, and Chris looks just like this Duke back in Meridia, and so it's up to Edward to convince Chris to help him out, and eventually he talks Chris around to it. But Elijah, being Chris's best friend, they've come through medical school and their medical residencies together. He's like, okay, buddy, you can do this crazy thing, but guess what? I'm going to come along too.
Great. That's fantastic. So, you know, you mentioned that you did put quite a bit of yourself into Chris's character with the, you know, him being a physician, your experience in the medical profession as well. How do you think that you did this with all of your characters? How much of yourself do you typically put into each one of your characters?
It honestly varies. There's a little bit of me in Chris. There is a little bit of me in Robert. There is a little bit of what I wish was me in a couple of other characters. Elijah's sister, Naomi, for one, she's a person who just speaks her mind and never mind the consequences, and there are days when I wish I could be like that.
Oh.
Yeah, then you come to characters like Cecilia, who is one of the villains in A Prince in Need.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen my dark side. And so it's, even though she isn't me, she is something that I could turn into if things became very bad. And sometimes she's a character that I really don't want to get close to.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends. Nicole is another character in A Prince in Need. She is actually Chris's former fiance.
Mm-hmm.
And she and Naomi decide to follow the guys to Meridia. Well, there's a bit of Nicole in me, there's a bit of me in Nicole as well,
mm-hmm.
Some aspects of her character. So, yeah, it works its way in there. And, of course, writers have a tendency to also other people around them.
Yeah.
They may take personality quirks and, you know, develop that into characters. But you have to be careful because, you know, you can't name the character after a real person.
Yes, you might not have very many friends left after you put your book out.
Exactly. You know, unless it's a very flattering portrait.
Right. That's so funny. Well, as a writer, tell us a little bit about doing that, writing these characters with little bits of you in them. How you as a writer sort of utilize the form of writing as creative expression in getting to, I don't know yourself deeper, or I don't know. It's just a very interesting way to express yourself.
It is an interesting way to express yourself, and honestly, it has been a learning experience for me. I'm still learning, especially now as I begin to develop new stories and new characters. And, of course, I don't want to repeat characters. I don't want to have, you know, very much in the way of stereotypical characters. Occasionally that works, but you don't want to do that. My goal is to try to develop characters that readers can either relate to in some way, shape, or form, or at least care about them. Of course, this gets a little bit dicey with the villains, but
we love to
hate them.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes it's just as much fun to give them some kind of redeeming quality.
Mm.
Like, you know, they'll pet the dog.
Right.
You know, they may be a pet lover even while they're, you know, doing all these
terrible,
evil things.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, give something of a backstory because, you know, it's like, well, why is this person so psychotic?
Yeah.
Give people a reference point so they can at least, if they don't agree with, you know, the behavior, at least understand where some of it's coming from.
No, in fantasy novels, typically you're working on the theme of good versus evil. So how does this series and the two books so far, or maybe if you just want to focus on A Prince in Need, how does the good versus evil theme sort of play out? And what are some of the deeper themes that you really wanted to bring out in this book?
Well, to talk specifically about A Prince in Need, the whole good versus evil is a little bit gray, which I kind of like because the king of Meridia, Reginald Claiborne, who is murdered basically in the beginning chapter, well, he is not exactly the nicest man out there, and it's not up to me to decide, of course, whether or not he deserved to be murdered, but, you know, here he is murdered, but the people who were responsible for his death, well, they have a legitimate grievance. The problem they begin to run into is, well, where do you stop with the punishing? Because now it's a brother and sister team, Cecilia and Sebastian. Well, Sebastian's like, no, it's Reginald and Christian. Those are the ones that, you know, murdered our family. I don't have a, you know, problem with Reginald's children. They haven't done anything to me. Whereas Cecilia's like, I don't care. They're all Claibornes. They all deserve to die. So this is, you know, even though Reginald's death may be justified in, you know, in some people's minds, where, you know, Cecilia's taking it too far. She's in getting into, okay, now you're talking about murdering people who had nothing to do with your family's death several years back. They were children.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah, it kind of explores some of that, you know.
There's
evil, and then there's, I don't know, you know, we call it justifiable homicide today.
Right, right, of course. There's so many different layers that you can go on that whole theme of good versus evil. What about the whole idea of the church and magic? Where did that sort of come about for you in writing, and how did you come up with that idea?
Well, like I said, I had read these books before where magic and church were always opposed, and
yeah.
I find religious history very interesting, and I'm very interested in all kinds of religious systems. In fact, I'm going to be exploring some more and expanding, so to speak, on another series that I'm writing. But as far as this one, the church at that period, of course, was very powerful, very important, and this gives me a way to play with it
mm-hmm.
while keeping it still somewhat true to the historical period, but still have some fun with it. But it also gives me the opportunity of introducing characters who, while they are loyal members of the same church, they're like, we're stagnating here. Can we, you know, can we have a little bit of flexibility with the rituals? Whereas the church is like, no, we have to do it this way. This is the only way.
Mm.
And in some ways it's like, yeah, but it might be a little bit safer if we did it this way instead.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that whole political subplot going on.
Mm-hmm. Is that going to go through all five books in the series?
Yeah, it does develop more into each of the successive books. In the third book, I actually introduce a dark side to the magic.
Oh.
Yes, and then by the time I get to the fourth book, I'm actually pulling in another pagan magical system as well, and I get to have some real fun with that when I've got one of the characters using a more pagan, more nature-based magic against somebody who is a dark practitioner, and when an aspect of the devil actually comes, he just basically steps aside to let the goddess, if you will, and this other practitioner work it out.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, how are the younger readers? I mean, that, you know, adults have quite a bit, maybe, prior knowledge of some of history where the younger readers may not. How are they relating to some of those, the church and magic, and now the, well, your third book isn't out yet, but how are they relating to this thread of your series?
Well, I had the opportunity late last year to attend a book festival in Vero Beach, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that, I was able to visit with the high school down there where a number of the high school students had actually read one or both of the books at the time, and the feedback they were giving me was just tremendously positive. They were enjoying the adventure aspects, the political aspects, the religious aspects, and when I told them that I was branching out into some other religious systems, they were like, oh, that is so cool.
They love it.
Yeah, they can really, I don't know, they can relate to it.
Because yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Deborah Colleen, author of A Prince in Need. You can find out more about Deborah through her website, www.meridia.net.
My goal is not to disparage anybody's religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say, look, we've got a lot of belief systems out there. They're all valid to one degree or another. And, in fact, that's actually going to be an overarching theme of a second series I actually plan to do in Universe, where the characters go on crusade.
In Meridia.
In Meridia.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so I've been doing a lot of research into, of course, the Jewish religion and trying to work out a magical system with that, and also the Islamic religion and trying to pull into a little bit of magic into that as well. And, you know, one of the themes is just going to be about religious tolerance.
Mm.
And I have no idea how they're going to work out yet, but...
But that's fascinating. There is a lot. If you do like deeper research into some of these very old religions, there is a lot of mysticism back in there.
Yes, there is.
Mm-hmm. So, what was your upbringing like? Were you raised in a strongly religious household? Like, where did this interest come from?
Well, I will be perfectly honest. I was raised in the Baptist church.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was growing up, I thought the Roman Catholic religion was fascinating just because it was so different from what I had grown up with. And I've always been open-minded as far as other religious beliefs go. And I have a real issue with anybody who says, well, only so-and-so, certain people are going to heaven. I don't buy that at all.
Yeah. Very fear-based.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I currently identify as more of a pagan, close to Wicca for my own practice. But, again, I accept anybody's religious beliefs.
Mm. I was wondering if you tended towards more pagan influence by the name of a few of your cats.
Yes. Yeah, the cat names are a whole nother story.
I bet.
Scott was named during a quantum leap period.
Oh.
This little white.
Oh, you mean hair. Scott Bakula?
Scott Bakula, yes.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, your life obviously very much intertwines in science fiction and mysticism and fantasy.
Well, my dad read a lot of science fiction, and he introduced me to some science fiction when I was young as well. Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, who is still one of America's finest writers. And, you know, some of those folks, and I've still maintained an interest. I went through a period where I was like, oh, yeah, I want to be an astronaut, and, of course, now you couldn't get me to leave planet Earth for anything.
Yeah. I can really see how you felt your career in Western medicine was incredibly stifling to you.
Yeah, and now I'm open to alternative medicine as well as what we think of as modern medicine.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk a little bit to the fact that you bring quite a bit of female characters into the second book.
Oh, yeah.
So tell us about I think the main girls are Nicole and Naomi. So, and there's some other predominant girls.
Yeah, there's Alice and Amelia.
So tell us about why you decided to bring the feminine aspect into book two?
Well, I'll tell you one of my favorite phrases. And also, I studied pharmacy in school, but I was a frustrated history major. I could have studied history just as easily. And one of the funniest things I ever heard about history, and I just love to repeat it from time to time, is history is a bunch of agreed-upon lies written by the winners. And so you have to, you know, when you read history, you have to take it with a grain of salt and say, okay, whose agenda are we really looking at here?
Mm.
And I'm enough of a feminist myself to know that women were doing things throughout history. Okay, maybe they weren't, you know, fighting the wars and signing the treaties and all that, but women were running households, women ran businesses, women helped on the farms, women were involved. Maybe all their names didn't get into the books, but women were doing things. And sometimes fantasy can be just a little bit too guy-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to, you know, people my worlds with a lot of women warriors, at least not this universe. I can't rule it out for something else down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the Crusade books, I'm actually basing a character on a coworker of mine who was from Eastern Europe, and she is actually going to be a noble woman who is a trained fighter. But I found it interesting that a lot of my magical practitioners, the stronger ones, are women. And I think it's partly because there's that whole aspect of women being more in tune with their emotions and things going around them, and so they are just more attuned to that magical energy that's in this universe.
Well, when you look back historically, I mean, you have to really search for historical books that are talking about women being powerful way back then. You know, a lot of that was stifled, was covered up because, you know, of a patriarchal type of, I don't know, takeover almost.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting. And the women were very strong and the original healers, I believe.
A lot of them were. And we all have heard of Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Mm.
I mean, she was just amazing, the things she was able to do with her life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you talk to younger girls that have read the book, you know, when you went to the high school, what did they have to say about these characters?
Overall, they had positive things to say. You know, they have different favorites as far as, you know, who their favorite characters are. Some of them, like Helen, who Chris is now with.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, of course, identify with Allison because she is a teenager. She's going through some of the same things that teens are going through. And, you know, some of them like Robert, some of them like Chris. My personal favorite character is Edward because he is thoroughly obnoxious, and yet he's one of the good guys. So he is an absolute joy to write.
I bet. So why did you decide to bridge the modern world with the medieval world of Meridia and not just, you know, have it all take place in Meridia? What were you wanting to basically convey about the modern world right now?
Well, I just thought it would have both comedic and dramatic possibilities, putting people into a completely alien situation. And and while this isn't strictly time travel, I'm a sucker for time travel stories. And just that whole, well, what if and how would you adapt to, you know, an environment that is completely alien to what you're used to. And, in fact, I'm going to get to have that in the reverse as well, because I'm going to be doing a spinoff series where Naomi and Sebastian actually travel. Naomi comes back to the modern world and Sebastian comes with her.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, so it's going to be fun just him, you know, encountering things like coffee.
Ooh.
Cars, planes.
TV.
Yeah, TV. Cell phones, you know.
Oh, gosh, computers. Oh, that's so interesting. You have a lot of really great ideas. I mean, you really are jumping into this novel writing career.
I am loving it.
That's great. That's great. So do you, as a writer, have a particular focus?
Particular focus? My first goal is to tell what I hope is an entertaining story. And hopefully I succeed at that. And so far, the feedback I've been getting from a lot of people, they're enjoying the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And my other goal is to develop characters that readers can either identify with or at least care about. And that is also some feedback I've been getting from readers of all ages, that they just really they care about these characters and they want to know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't always sit down and say, okay, I want a particular theme for this book, but inevitably themes,
Well, of course they would.
Yeah. And one of the themes of An Unlikely Duke and A Prince as well, I mean, it's about relationships. In some ways, it's about unlikely relationships and, you know, the importance of friendship and loyalty and even on occasion, I dare say, love.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a little romance in your book.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you see, when you're writing, You sound to me like you'd be a very visual person. And I mean, you're talking about Scott Bakula and you know, the TV series and that. So do you see, as you write visually, as if you're, you know, watching a movie kind of a thing?
Sometimes some of the scenes do, when I go back and read them, they do feel like they could easily be converted to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, my sister has taken it several years to take one of the novels and replay
a screenplay
on it.
Yeah.
Just to see how it would work out, because we both know something be cut. But it would be fun just to see.
I think this would transfer very well into.
I think it would.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a wide appeal for this story, I believe, anyway. So I think that would be a great experiment for you two. So what? Let me ask you. You wrote these books before, self-published them, and then were picked up by Helm Publishing?
Correct.
So, you know, this is really, for authors who have self-published, I mean, it really is, you want to get published. You want to be picked up by a publisher. So tell us what your secret was to getting picked up by a publisher. We all want to know. And then maybe some advice for new writers that are just kind of at the beginning stages of following their dream.
Okay, it was pure luck.
Mm.
Yes, I was at Dragon Con in 2005. That's a big fantasy science fiction convention in Atlanta every year. And I was trying to sell a few copies of the self-published version of An Unlikely Duke, and there were a few publishers there, and Helm was in the dealer's room selling books, and I asked the publisher there if they were accepting submissions. She said, yeah, here's my card. Send me the first few chapters. And, you know, this was, of course, after I had already, you know, sent to some agents. I was getting ready to send out to a number of other agents and continued to get rejections, but Helm accepted An Unlikely Duke, and then they accepted A Prince in Need. In fact, I've just sent them the third manuscript, and I'm hoping to hear back that she's going to take that one as well. She has been very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And she said her opinion was the second one was better than the first one, and we'll see how that goes. But all I can tell aspiring writers is to, first off, believe in what you're doing. Because if you don't believe in your writing, nobody else is going to. You have to be willing to share it with people. An important thing I have found is to have a couple of early readers. And these are people whose feedback and opinions you can trust. They're not just going to say, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. If that's all you want, give it to your mom.
Oh, that's a good point. Watch those family members.
Yeah. Now, I'm fortunate because one of my early readers is my sister. She's not a fantasy fan.
Mm-hmm.
She has an English degree. She is a fine editor, and she will immediately tell me, okay, this needs clarity, this needs fixing, this is great, you know, and, you know, it's very mixed feedback, but it's feedback I can trust.
Great.
I also have that with a couple of other readers. One is a former coworker, and another is one of my neighbors, and you just never know where you're going to find these folks, but their input is critical, and I can't emphasize that enough.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to be persistent.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
gosh.
Eventually you will find the agent or the publisher that is willing to go on the journey with you. And of course it doesn't stop there. After that, you've got to market.
Oh yes, and that's a whole other ball game right there.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've found it's an adventure, and writers may think of themselves as retiring people, but you do have to get out there.
Oh.
If you don't tell people about your book, nobody's going to know.
No, there's so many books out there, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because that I think a lot of writers end up putting out the first book not realizing that was just the first step, you know, that the marketing and promotions aspect of it is just a whole job unto itself.
Yeah.
And I think it's also very powerful, the fact that you went to a conference and were picked up by a publisher. You know, I talk maybe a little to the importance of going to conferences and really networking in the way that you did, and probably continue to do, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Everything you do is an opportunity. When I was at a recent business meeting, we had some social time, and, you know, I'd be talking to people that I work with on a regular basis, okay, maybe not out of my office, but certain vendors that we work with, and so I would happen to mention, oh, yeah, and by the way, I also write, you know, fiction. I'm published, and, you know, that leads to something else. It may lead to a sale, or it's an opportunity to share your business card with somebody. Meeting writers. I go to at least a couple of conventions every year, and I meet writers there, and that's always good because, you know, they may be promoting you while they're promoting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I have no problems with that. You know, we're all trying to, you know, have as much success as we can manage. And
right.
It helps.
That's great. Now, is there anything that you need to keep in mind when you are writing for young adults?
There are a couple of things I will not do. I do make a conscious effort to, at least with the nature of these stories, to keep the bad language to a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
First off, it's more effective when it's used judiciously, and most of the time it's not necessary. Another place I won't go is child molestation.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, to me, that is the big taboo.
Yeah.
And it may be something that you can allude to that may have happened in the past, but there is no need for details. And, yeah, and those are probably the big things. Otherwise, mm-hmm. at least in writing for teens, I've read a number of books now that are out there, and you can pretty much go anywhere you want.
Mm-hmm. Adult themes work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with slightly younger kids, yeah, you want to tone down the violence. I mean, you know, a lot of the kids, they don't mind the violence, but I think there are ways you can, you know, put in, you know, characters may die.
Yeah.
You know, there are ways you can say it without being completely graphic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It just takes maybe a little more creativity in figuring out, you know, to appeal to a younger. Do you ever think about writing for younger children?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am writing now a book that's what I hope is the first of a series for middle grade.
Oh, okay.
Readers.
Fantasy?
Yeah. It's also fantasy. It's what we call urban fantasy. It takes place in the contemporary world, and this one, the main character, she is an apprentice witch, and basically a fairy falls into her lap one day.
Oh,
and there is a definite environmental message with this one.
Oh, great.
It has been a lot of fun to write, and I belong to a writing group.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the writers in my group just happens to be an eighth-grade English teacher.
Mm.
And she's been sharing a couple of the chapters with her students, and she said the students are just loving it.
Mm.
So, but she tells me when I use words that may be a little bit too complicated for the kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then again, that's valuable feedback.
Oh, definitely. I think it's really wonderful that you are putting really current themes into your books. I think that's very powerful. We need more. We need more fantasy writing that bridges that.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, it's been so great having you on the program today. I think that your books, I mean, I know we're going to be talking again. You have got a lot of books, didn't you?
Yes, I think I do. This has been a lot of fun to me.
Great. Well, let's mention your website again. It's myridia.net, and that's myridia.net. And I just want to let you have the final say here. So if you have any final thoughts for listeners that you want to put out there, please do.
Well, one thing I would certainly like to tell anybody listening out there, not just people who want to be writers, any kind of artistic endeavor, just keep at it. The world is in need of it, and if that's your dream, follow your dream. It may seem impossible now, but eventually it will work out.
You're a testament to that, so thank you so much, Deborah, and we will definitely talk again. All the best to you.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
You too.
All right, listeners, I have been talking with Deborah Colleen. Her new book, A Prince in Need, is book 2 in her Meridia series. And the first book, An Unlikely Duke, they're both available through her website, www.meridia.net, as well as through local and online booksellers. So please do check it out. This is a wonderful series, wonderful book. We are going to be seeing much, much more from Deborah in the future. So get in on her writing career now. I think you're going to really enjoy her books. So thank you again for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson. And until next time.